This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
We're hearing the word grit a lot these days when it comes to education. The popular narrative is if a student has grit and determination, then they will be successful no matter what racial and financial roadblocks are in their way. A longtime educator has her doubts.
I think so many schools perpetuate a myth that if you're gritty, if you think about yourself in that way, you will be fine.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk about the new book called When Grit Isn't Enough. We'll also spend an academic minute learning from our mistakes. Hopefully. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Have you heard this one before? If you have enough grit and determination, you'll always succeed. Well, how about this one? Everyone can and should go to college. These are either truisms or myths, depending on your outlook. Linda Nathan was a believer of the former who has converted to the latter. In her new book called When Grit Isn't Enough, a high school principal examines how poverty and inequality thwart the college for all promise, Dr. Nathan confronts long-held assumptions about college access and takes a sobering look at how current practices and policies push poor and first-generation students off the college track. Dr. Linda Nathan is the executive director of the Center for Artistry and Scholarship and has taught at Harvard Graduate School of Education for 15 years. Before that, she was the founding headmaster at Boston Arts Academy, the city's only school for visual and performing arts. I asked her why she took on this project.
Yeah, well, I've been a high school principal headmaster in the Boston Public Schools 38 years. I started as a teacher, and I had the privilege of running not one, but two high schools. Fenway High School was the first I was co-director, and then the founding headmaster of Boston Arts Academy, which is the first visual and performing arts high school in Boston. That was back in 1998. When I stepped down from being the principal, I asked the current principal, how can I be helpful? What can I do? And she said, interview some of the alums, find out what's going on with them. And I had written a first book, The Hardest Questions Aren't on the Test, about the founding of this wonderful high school. So I didn't think I was going to write a second book. But in doing those interviews, and I did over 80, these five myths, themes, assumptions emerged, and they became the foundation for this book.
What was the promise, going back to Boston Arts Academy, that you made your students in the beginning of each year?
Yeah, so I would always say, all of you will go on to college, you know, or have a professional career. And I still believe that was the right thing to promise, but I think the emphasis was wrong now in retrospect. I think I should have done more to really prepare kids for a professional world of work and to think about other ways than just four-year college to get to work and to think about everyone needs preparation after high school. Everyone needs post-secondary preparation. It is still true in this country that wages are correlated with the number of years you go to school. But I do think career and technical education is vital to both the health of our country and the health of our kids. And so not everyone is going to go do a four-year liberal arts degree. And I think that promise needs to be considered. And that sort of led me to really look at this grit myth that is so perpetuated in so many middle schools. You know, if you're gritty, you'll go to college. And it really led me to examine that myth and how we like to assume that all of this is so individually associated. If you work hard, you'll be a success. Now, it is true. The opposite is also true. You know, if you don't work hard, you will not be a success. So you need grit and determination. But I think so many schools perpetuate a myth that if you're gritty, if you think about yourself in that way, you will be fine. And what I found in this book, by examining both the kids that went on to college and succeeded, and the kids that went on to college and didn't succeed, and the kids that never went, is that there's a lot about structural racist systems that are impeding so many of our young people from being successful. And I don't think that I had done enough to examine that. I wrote this book, I should just say, when my own children were attending college. And so I was having this very intense experience of my privileged white children, who were fabulous, and how they were negotiating college while I was interviewing kids that were not white and privileged, and seeing what they were encountering. And the differences were stunning, very stark.
Here you are, Harvard Graduate School of Education. Does that background make it more difficult to evolve on this topic of everyone going to college?
Well, that's interesting. You mean for me personally?
Yes.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting because I have colleagues at Harvard I cite in the book and cite their work. Nancy Hoffman runs Jobs for the Future, and a lot of her international work is what I cite in terms of the strength of career and technical education in other countries. So her work was very, very helpful to me. I want to make sure that listeners understand college is not, I mean, it is such a critical piece of the puzzle for so many kids. But I do think our pre-K through 12 education system has to re-embrace career and technical education, and not as a dumping ground, but as a legitimate way of giving kids what I'm going to call apprentice learning. And I think that if our high schools continue to just be geared towards getting kids into college, we're doing kids a disservice. I really do believe that there are many, many fields out there, STEM fields, digital fields, that require a two-year associate's degree or a technical degree, and we have to do better. We just have to do better at making sure our kids know that those jobs also get you to lead a middle-class life. And I don't feel like everyone needs to do a liberal arts degree. So does my Harvard background thwart that in some way? I think it complicates it because, of course, I've benefited greatly from my own privilege, my own white skin, my own Harvard pedigree. And here I am saying, does everyone benefit from that? You know, that could be considered hypocritical.
You spoke earlier about the five assumptions about college that have driven school reform. What are those five assumptions, and how did you come to just narrow it down to that?
Yeah. So you have to have quotation marks, air quotes, around each of them. So the first is money doesn't have to be an obstacle. Put quotes around that. And, of course, I'm writing that from a position of privilege, a position of someone who has money, whose children had money to go to college. And again, my alums told me stories about how incredibly difficult it was for them to navigate life after high school because of insufficient funds. And sometimes we're talking about really small insufficient funds. Sometimes we're talking about not having read the small print, not understanding that full tuition scholarship does not include housing. And so you end up taking out a loan. Well, then you can't keep doing that because you don't have the means to keep doing that every year. And so you have to leave school, and then you're carrying this huge amount of debt. You know, so this chapter, I'm not an economist, but if I could have kept writing about money, I would have written about the debt crisis in this country with too many of our young black and brown kids, our first generation kids, for whom one mistake about money means the difference between having a degree and having loans that you'll never be able to pay off. So that's the first assumption that I think folks of privilege, wealthier people, just don't think about, because so many middle class kids have someone to turn to bail them out. And so many of our first-generation college-going kids or kids that are just barely scraping by do not have that. And I think in this country, if we don't understand that and embrace that, we're losing an enormous number of kids who should be going to college, should be finishing college, and are not. And that really scares me. So that's the first assumption. The second is race doesn't matter. I was writing this book when Obama was elected, and, you know, this notion that finally we were a colorblind society. And the kinds of stories my kids talked about, the microaggressions, if you will, I don't know if they were so micro. I think they were really macro. But the notion of being on a college campus and being the only one, asking for an African-American student association or a house that honors the contributions of kids of color, any of those kinds of things on predominantly white campuses, and getting administrators who say, why do we need that? And the young students saying, well, you've got lots of buildings and houses named after white people. Why can't we have same named after black people or people of color? So really the stories of how present race and racism is on so many of our campuses, and how this is really also problematic for our white kids, particularly white kids that come from an integrated high school, you know, that they're seeing these same kinds of aggressions and wishing for more diversity on their college campuses. So, you know, what I end up talking about in the book, besides these stories, is our responsibility as educators to really think about how do you teach racial justice, how do you teach an anti-racist curriculum. And that is work that, particularly in this current political climate, we need to be vigilant about continuing. So that's the second. And then the third is, I was sort of referencing it earlier, this notion of just work harder, this idea that comes from, you know, positive psychology, a lot of Angela Duckworth's work. Just work harder. If you're gritty, if you can, you know, just demonstrate tenacity, you too will be successful. And I really think this notion, and I tell a story of, you know, the way this slant behavior, not that it's inherently wrong, sit up, look, ask questions, nod, track the speaker, nothing wrong about that. But the kinds of classrooms that we've created where we're policing black and brown bodies and young bodies, that to me is very worrisome, and this sort of militarization of our classrooms. So that was the third assumption. And then the fourth, about everyone can go to college, is probably the hardest for me because, of course, I want everyone to go to college, but I don't think creating a K-12 school system where that is the only goal makes sense. And I do think we have to do better with career and technical education. And I give some examples of that. And then finally, the fifth chapter, which is a little more hopeful, is about, you know, some absolutely amazing alumni of mine that if you believe, your dreams will come true. And of course, for them, it did. And I talk a lot about why I think that's so and the kinds of schools I think we need so that dreams can come true.
Still to come, our conversation with Dr. Linda Nathan continues with a look at how race played a part in the college experience of some of her students. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett, and our guest today is Dr. Linda Nathan, author of the new book, When Grit Isn't Enough, A High School Principal Examines How Poverty and Inequality Thwart the College for All Promise. In the book, she talks about Kendra and Denise, two of her students from Boston Arts Academy who went on to college and had very different college experiences.
Yeah, I mean, I think what's interesting about the two of them, and I think, you know, it's easy for somebody to say, well, Kendra got it, Denise didn't. You know, Kendra had the support, Denise didn't. And all of that's true. But I think Denise's experience is very representative of what so many young people experience on campus. And for Denise, I would say, or she would say, that the microaggressions were just too much. It was too lonely. It was too difficult. There wasn't enough support for students like her. And I think so many colleges today think that if we just do a six-week support class, that's all these kids need. And in fact, when you're going to a very white campus and you've come from a very different background, you don't just need 6 weeks. You need some kind of ongoing support. And I think you need a campus that understands, you know, if you ask for a Black student union, for example, why that would be important. And you need adults on that campus to embrace that. I think it's actually Aaron that tells the story of, you know, wanting to name something for a Black person, and his white administrator says, why would we do that? And he sort of looks around and says, well, everything else here is named for white people. Why can't you have something named for a Black person? You know, those are the kind of insensitive comments that kids of color hear all the time.
You close out the book with your conclusion, of course, and you give a little list of what you feel are the purposes of education. And the first one you wrote really struck me, helping students understand the context of their lives. Explain exactly what you mean by that.
Well, I think school is about preparing one to understand both the world you live in today and the world you want to create. You can't solve problems unless you understand their history and their rootedness in one's own community. And I really believe that that's what school should be about, is helping students with that. For me, as a founder of Boston Arts Academy, we did that through the arts, you know, that kids saw themselves as artist scholars that could redraw the world, but they first had to understand the world they were living in. And so that's what I'm talking about there.
Well, finally, are you hopeful? Looking around at the current political and educational climate, are you hopeful of the future?
Yeah. Well, I always have the water bottle half full, even when it's looking half empty, because I have to be hopeful. I think as a teacher, I'm enormously hopeful because every day there's amazing young people around me and amazing teachers around me that keep me hopeful. I'm terrified. You know, this latest idea of arming teachers is so frightening to me. I don't even know which way to go on that. I want to arm teachers with flutes and violins and paintbrushes. So I'm hopeful about how teachers and young people can change the world for us. I really am hopeful. I think in some way these recent violent tragedies in our schools are helping young people organize for change. And we need change. We absolutely do.
You have a two-minute meeting with Betsy DeVos. What would you say?
Yeah. Well, I would say, where do we agree, Betsy? I don't think she's Dr. DeVos. And I think we would agree on the importance of career and technical education. So I think she could invest more dollars there. I think we would agree on the importance of literacy and libraries, so we could invest more in making sure that all of our schools have libraries. I think we would agree on physical education and the arts. So I know she's done a lot of supporting of arts institutions, so we could work on that together. So let's start with where we agree, and then we can talk about the for-profit colleges that she endorses and some of her other rather crazy, loony ideas later. But let's start with where we agree first.
You really do take it to for-profit colleges in the book.
I do, because I think those are so frightening, and I think they prey on young people, particularly poor young people, and they take federal dollars, which I think should be made criminal. I don't care if they exist on their own, but don't take the federal dollars that go to young people for scholarships and use them for a for-profit college. I think that should be outlawed.
And actually, when you say they're taking federal dollars, it's kind of in a roundabout way. The federal
That's
government
right.
isn't writing a check to them.
Exactly. But it's very disingenuous. I don't think their graduation rates are anywhere where they say they are. I don't think that they do ever. I have yet to see a for-profit college that has stats that I would be proud of. So I think the notion that this should be a expanding sector in education really scares me.
One more, and I have just started hearing this word in education as an education reporter. The word grit is really starting to become popular, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, no, I think actually maybe it's winding down. That's what I'm hoping. But yeah, I mean, I think I really spend quite a bit of time in the book explaining where this all came from and how this became almost synonymous with what's called no excuses charter schools, where, you know, no excuses for poverty or background or race, all of which is, you know, that's sort of a lovely idea, but it decontextualizes and makes almost ahistorical the importance of understanding the ways in which race and social class confound us. And it makes it that this myth of just pull yourself up by your bootstraps, and if you don't, it's your fault. I'm never saying in this book that you shouldn't take individual responsibility. I am saying that it is much more complicated than just having grit.
Again, the name of Dr. Linda Nathan's book is When Grit Isn't Enough, A High School Principal Examines How Poverty and Inequality Thwart the College for All Promise. Well, us wacky humans will always make mistakes, but will we always learn from them? That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
It pays to learn from your mistakes. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Samuel Sober, assistant professor in the biology department at Emory University, explores which part of our brain avoids making the same error twice.
Our brains are constantly learning from their mistakes. This is especially important in skilled behaviors such as speech, where the brain monitors the sound of our own voices and uses this information to correct errors in our vocal production. Songbirds perform similar feats of vocal learning, using sensory information to modify their songs in response to auditory inputs. Although we know a lot about how sound is processed by the nervous system, it remains a mystery how error signals are transmitted to the parts of the brain that control behavior. Our laboratory recently used songbirds to test a hypothesis about how error signals are transmitted during vocal behavior. Bengalese finches are songbirds with extremely precise singing behavior and are highly sensitive to errors in auditory feedback. We used these birds to test the hypothesis that error signals are carried by the neurotransmitter dopamine within a small part of the songbird basal ganglia, a brain region known to be involved in learning. We tested the birds' learning abilities by playing blasts of loud noise whenever the birds sang within a particular range of vocal pitches. Over time, finches changed the pitch of their songs to avoid these bursts of noise. We found that experimentally reducing dopamine in a small part of the songbird's brain did not interfere with the bird's song performance or motivation to sing, but dramatically reduced the bird's ability to change their songs to avoid auditory errors. Our results suggest that dopamine regulates vocal learning by transmitting error signals to the motor system. Our future work will examine how dopamine regulates patterns of brain activity during learning, and we hope to use this work to shed light on the learning deficits that can accompany neurological disorders in humans that alter dopamine function.
That was Samuel Sober of Emory University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at @TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at wamc.org.